Thank you. Good morning. Please be seated. The first case is State versus Sowers.
Good morning. I may please the court, Mick Vranarevsky with the Washington Appellate Project on behalf of Mr. Jeff Sowers. I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal, please. When a gun went off and Mr. Sowers' fiancée, Monica Gallarosa, was accidentally struck by the bullet, Mr. Sowers summoned aid for his fiancée. He summoned aid for her even though he knew that questions would be asked, what was a handgun doing in the home of a convicted felon in the first place? The police assumed the worst, as did the state, and they prosecuted Mr. Sowers, despite the assertion that this had been an accident. The trial court's erroneous ruling, which admitted as substantive evidence Ms. Gallarosa's out-of-court statement made at the hospital to the police, calls for reversal. It calls for reversal because that ruling made it easier for the state to convict Mr. Sowers. Separately, the trial court's error at sentencing, the refusal to consider that the two firearms, which are at the same place at the same time, should have only counted as 1 point toward Mr. Sowers' offender score under the same criminal conduct rule, requires a new sentencing.
Are you then resting on your briefing for the necessity instruction that the court did not give?
I am, Your Honor. Likewise, I will rest on the briefing with respect to the unanimity question. 801D1 allows a witness's prior statement to be used as substantive evidence at a trial if that statement originally was given under oath, subject to the penalty of perjury, and it was first given at a trial, hearing, other proceeding, or in a deposition. Now, I think
so this would be an other proceeding?
Well, that's how the Supreme Court has interpreted the taking of a statement from a witness by the police somewhere out of court. And we are not challenging the Smith affidavit procedure, Your Honor. We are challenging the application of the rule to these facts.
So you don't dispute that there was a statement taken in an other proceeding?
No.
All right. And so your then focus is on whether it was under oath. And I think you're relying on the, I may be saying it wrong, but the McComas case?
Yes, Your Honor. I think the McComas case is directly applicable. Several times over now, this court has strictly applied the oath requirement to these types of out-of-court declarations.
So are you saying that the facts are the same?
The facts are essentially the same. In McComas, we were dealing with an audio-recorded statement with the same oath as what was given here. That oath in McComas was administered at the end of the statement, as it was to Ms. Gallarosa. There was no transcription done, no opportunity for the declarant to review the statement that the proponent, the state here, offered as substantive evidence. I think the cases cannot be distinguished on that basis.
Isn't it more appropriate that the person have a chance to review their statement where they dictated it and it's been put down in handwriting by the person listening to it, so there's some question about whether it's an accurate taking down of the statement? Here it was recorded, and there's no challenge to the accuracy of the recording.
Well, I think there are two things at play, Your Honor. One is, it is what is put forth an accurate description of what the witness said when they made the statement. But even more importantly, I think, is the requirement that when the witness made that statement, was it under oath? If we look at ER 603, the rule there requires that every witness who testifies in court or at a deposition must be sworn prior to the giving of testimony, and the purpose of that rule, and I'd like to just read the second half of it, that the requirement of 603 is that the swearing in of the witness is calculated to awaken the witness's conscience and impress the witness's mind with the duty to do so, to follow the oath. I think that's the reason why this court has been so strict in requiring either the presence of a notary, who most certainly administers an oath and gives the witness the opportunity to correct and review a statement, which is what occurred in Smith, the case that originally allowed for this procedure to go forward. Does that answer the court's question?
Mm-hmm.
I think that the court should certainly find the oath that was administered to Ms. Gairosa as insufficient. I'd briefly like to switch over to the question of prejudice, because there is a reasonable probability that but for this wrongful admission of the statement, the outcome of the proceeding would have been different. Mr. Sowers was looking at an assault second-degree charge, which involved an allegation that he behaved recklessly, an assault third-degree charge for which he was convicted with an allegation that he behaved negligently. He defended on both those counts with an assertion that this had been an accident. Juries make compromised verdicts all the time, and I think that's what we're seeing here. The prosecutor, as a result of the statement of Ms. Gairosa's coming in as substantive evidence, was able to denigrate what she said in court under oath to the jury that tried Mr. Sowers and elevate to the same level, if not higher, what she said out of court on a hospital bed while on drugs that had been given to her by her physician. The prosecutor, in closing argument, described Ms. Gairosa's statement at the hospital as the most truthful moment in the investigation. And the prosecutor would not have been able to do that had the statement only come in for impeachment value, which is how it should have been coming in. And then the prosecutor denigrates what Ms. Gairosa and what Mr. Sowers say in court as just a court version of that same old dog ate my homework story. This is a reference to Mr. Sowers' in-court testimony and Ms. Gairosa's in-court sworn testimony that the dog had been playing with the laser sight on the handgun, and Mr. Sowers' assertion that the gun goes off on accident when the dog nips him at the hand. This is why, and it was but for the trial court's ruling that the prosecutor was able to go to this extent in elevating the out-of-court statement. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning. I'm Jens Albert from the Snohomish County Prosecutor's Office. Probably the most important issue in this case is the issue that counsel just addressed, which is whether the victim's prior out-of-court statement was properly admitted. I want to jump ahead a little bit to talk about what happened if it was improperly admitted. Was there prejudice, or should the conviction be upheld regardless of whether that was admitted? There was nothing in the out-of-court statements that changed what the defendant had already said about his ownership, constructive and actual, of both weapons. He testified that the weapons, he had brought them into, or he told police, and that came into evidence. He had purchased the gun or helped purchase the gun. He had shot it. He had taught the victim how to use it. He had cleaned it. The evidence showed it was stored in his closet on his side. That was all from the defendant's own words. The evidence on the shotgun was that the shotgun was in the house for at least 4 weeks, the house that he shared with the victim. Everything that had anything to do with the shotgun was on his side of the closet. The shotgun was found on his side of the closet and had his DNA on it. So nothing that the victim said to the police had anything to do with those convictions. So it could not have been prejudicial. As far as the assault goes, that too, the victim's statement did not cause prejudice to the defendant because the result wouldn't have been different even if that statement hadn't come in. The evidence of what happened was very clear. According to the testimony at trial, including the defendant's statement that came in, there were two people in the house that day, the victim and the defendant. The defendant was a convicted felon who was very familiar with a gun that was in the living room with both people. The defendant had been playing with the dogs and gotten the dogs riled up, according to what he said. The victim said at trial that she brought the gun down from upstairs. According to both people at trial, they were both in relatively good moods, although the victim was high. according to what came in at trial, not counting the victim's statement, the victim then put the gun down and went upstairs. According to the defendant himself, the dog was not near the gun. The dog was biting at the laser dot from the gun. Despite being a convicted felon, the defendant decided to pick up the gun with which he was very familiar, having taught someone else how to shoot it, picked it up. Despite knowing about guns and knowing how to shoot it, the defendant pointed it up toward the second floor where the victim was. Despite that, he put his finger on the trigger. He didn't take the dog out of the house before he picked up the gun. He didn't move the dog to a closet. He didn't leash the dog. That's all evidence that came in, and the defendant pulled the trigger. There was no bite mark on his hand showing that the dog had jumped up and bit him, causing the gun to go off.
What was the evidence that the defendant pulled the trigger?
That the defendant pulled the trigger?
Yeah.
He said he did. He said he shot the gun. He said it was as a result of the dog jumping up and biting his hand. So that's the evidence at trial. The victim never said who shot her. So even if that statement was erroneously admitted, the convictions should still stand on all three counts.
So are you then abandoning the argument that you've made that McComas does not apply?
I am not. I'm just starting at the end, and now I'm going into that. Just doing
you're
it
backwards. Going backwards.
Okay. I am going backwards.
That's
why
good.
Not?
That's fine.
Yeah.
Well, tell us about your position on McComas.
Okay. When I read McComas, Judge, it was sort of interesting because they refer to this case, State versus Johnson, for the proposition that oral statements don't come in under 801D. They do it just as a C cite, not even that that's the proposition that the case stands for, but they do cite it for that. If you look back at Johnson, Johnson was about a case where the police took statements from several witnesses. None of the statements was sworn. None of the statements was made under any penalty of anything. They were just statements that the police took during their investigation. The issue in Johnson was whether the court had given a correct impeachment instruction, that those were only impeachment. It wasn't even about whether they were substantive. It was about the wording of the impeachment instruction. So that really in Johnson was virtually a throwaway line. It was just a dicta. That isn't what Johnson stands for. McComas took that language and applied it in this case to the Smith affidavit reasoning. And it says that for some reason they have read into EO1D a requirement that the prior witness statement can't be oral. They say a statement given to police, an oral statement, simply does not come in as substantive evidence. And that's just not the case. So in this case, what do you have? You have everything that Smith requires. You have a statement that has every guarantee of truthfulness that you could ever want, and especially if you look at the context in which it came up. The victim was shot and went to the hospital. 2 days later, the police went to talk to her. They determined she wasn't ready to talk. She was too out of it, and they left. She called them the next day and asked them to come back. She was ready to talk. They went back to the hospital and said, "What happened?" And she said, "I shot myself. I dropped the gun. It was an accident." They tell her, "No, the evidence doesn't support that. We know that the gun was shot from downstairs while you were upstairs. We have a trajectory. And we don't want to talk to you unless you're willing to tell the truth." She says, "Okay, I'll tell the truth." At that time, Detective Betts turned on the tape recorder, and she gave a statement. It was probably the most coherent statement she gave at all, because her statements at trial were all over the board. They were wild. It was hard to follow what she was saying. That statement that she gave, after she gave it, directly after she gave it, Betts read her the certification and declaration language, which makes it sworn. He read her that language not once, because the first time she said, "I'm not sure." He read it slowly. And after virtually every paragraph, she said, "Yeah, yeah, yeah." At the end of that, she said, "Okay, I get it." Not satisfied with her just saying, "Yes, I understand," he had her sign the statement. So this oral statement contained everything that the rule would require for a written statement had the statement been written out under 9A72085. All the guarantees of trustworthiness that the court requires in order to let a written statement in. So if you look at Smith.
So the written statement, it's not in the record.
I don't know if there is a written statement, Judge.
Well, she signed something. What's she signing?
She signed a piece of paper, that's right, and that piece of paper that she signed is not in the record. It wasn't required by defense. There was no objection to it. The court said, I think this is signed, and if you listen to the tape, which was made part of the record on appeal, you can hear it's very funny. So he says, do you understand this? Yes. Okay, I understand. Okay, sign here, and you can hear scritch, scratch, and then you hear Bet say, now I'm going to sign under your name. So the evidence is very clear that there was a written, there was a piece of paper on which she signed and declared that this was a sworn statement and this was true under penalty of perjury.
It would have been good to have it in the record.
It would have been awesome to have it in the record. Would have been great, and I kept thinking it had to have been attached to something, and it just wasn't. But that's a preliminary issue, Judge. That isn't even what you need for this. You have the evidence the judge said. You have the judge saying, I believe this is sworn, and the tape is going to show that it's sworn. It's right there on the tape. He says that when he makes his ruling letting the statement in. And so what more guarantee of trustworthiness could you have? As far as her being on drugs in the hospital, the judge made a credibility determination on that. He said that that was self-serving and that the jury was free to make of it whatever they wished. It went to weight, not admissibility.
So even though we haven't heard about the sentencing challenge, what's your position as to whether these two convictions should have been treated as the same?
The two convictions were properly treated as separate criminal conduct. And if you think about it, especially in light of all that testimony, you can see why. The rule is that you have to ask if the guns are, for UPF cases are in the same place at the same time with the same victim. Same time they were that day, same victim, yeah, it's society at large, it's the rest of us who don't want to get shot by felons. But if you say about the same place, where was the gun found? The gun was in the living room. And it's not unusual the gun was there. The defendant said he often had to take the gun from there when the victim left it and put it away. And so the way the gun was treated by these two people was very different from the way the rifle was treated. No one ever said the rifle was anyone but the victims, although he had constructive possession of it and sometimes actual. But the gun, he was very much more involved with that gun. And that's why they're separate, and that's what the judge recognized.
Thank you.
Thank you.